And tonight it is my great pleasure to welcome for the first time to Many Rivers our guest for the evening. Help Yourself to Happiness, a discussion on Vipassana meditation with Graham White. I've never met Mr. White before, just a few moments ago, but I have heard wonderful things about him, and I'm very much looking forward to someone who had the audacity to bring Vipassana to Australia. And so I'm looking forward to hearing whatever he has to say about this subject. Thank you so much for coming. We're very glad you could join us.
Thank you. I bought my translator over here, Mr. Tom Burnside. If you don't understand me or you miss a word or two, he will understand. He did a trip around Australia and he's learnt all Australian strong. So you'll have no problem with that as well.
He taught me confusion.
I'm in a little trouble with this seat. I'm used to sitting cross-legged and I'm thinking, can I get up on this or not? Or am I too senior? You know, cross my legs on this chair, I'm going to fall off and embarrass myself. So I'm tempted to do that.
That's fine, Chair.
Let's be a little bit bigger. What I'd like to talk about tonight is happiness. Now, but I thought I might just give a little history first, because what I do is I don't give a lot of formal talks like this, and hopefully this is not going to be a formal talk. It's not my thing. And what I rather do is teach you how to practice meditation. I'm sure a number of you, I know a number of friends are here, have practiced meditation before. My thing is to teach meditation, and so that's what I'd like to concentrate on tonight. For 40 years or so, I've been practicing this Vipassana meditation, which makes me very senior now, but I did start young. My time in the meditation world started many, many years ago in the late 60s. And it was a time, I'm a surfer. I have to put that right out there, right in the front. I surf. I'm full of craving for surfing. I have yet to attain Nibbana because surfing has got in the way as a hindrance. Right? So I like to say right from the outset that that's what happens. Even when I was a monk in Bodh Gaya, in 1970 or something, I spent a year as a monk practicing this practice, and I used to go. It was during rainy season, and the Bodh Gaya, of course, as many of you will know, is the place where the Buddha was enlightened, and a very special and deep place, wonderful vibration in this place. At that time, of course, there was nothing there. It was a village with only a few people around. In fact, I spent 3 months there as the only Westerner in town, 22 years or 23 years of age. I used to go to the river, which ran only during monsoon. And instead of being mindful of my walking and my body posture, I would be, you know, sneaking little looks at the little tubes that were coming off the sand, you know. So, oh no, not now, not now. I'm supposed to be mindful, you know, learning mindfulness, you know, not developing craving. So it would slip away, and you know, I think I was very holy, and the next minute there it is again. The craving was arising in the mind. And I'm sorry to say that 40 years later, that's still there. It hasn't gone away. Although I can restrain myself a little more now. So it is a result of meditation. I've learned restraint. That's something. But happiness is another thing. You know, and the Buddha taught... No, I won't go there. I'll go a little further back into the history lesson. When I first started to practice, though, was in England, actually, at a Thai monastery. And it came out of a surf trip. So it all relates back to surfing, which is, I'm sure is totally boring for you, but there's a point to this. We were travelling, my brother and I and a few other people were travelling through Sri Lanka at the time, you know, escaping the Vietnam War, actually. and we had our surfboards, and we were at this particularly beautiful place, like a Horseshoe Bay beach, you know, nice waves coming off the reef. But on the point of this bay, there was a temple. Now, in those days, when in Australian schools, we learned nothing about anything except how to be a metallurgist or something like that. So there was nothing taught about Southeast Asia, about religious traditions, not like it happens today. So we knew absolutely nothing. All we knew about was being Australian, which meant drinking a lot of beer, having a good time, chasing girls, and doing all this sort of thing. But we got to this place after travelling, you know, many countries through Africa and all this sort of thing, and coming to Sri Lanka. We came down through India and went to Sri Lanka. And I was walking along, and I felt, even in those days, I was feeling, you know, there was something happening in my mind, but I didn't know exactly what it was. I could feel a certain unease, even with all the good adventures we were having. You know, there was also a certain disquiet. We were walking along this beach, and I came to this temple, and in the distance, I was carrying the surfboard, and I was in this distance and coming along this beach, and I could see this figure. And it was dressed in these, some kind of robes, you know, which I'd only seen in Sri Lanka before. And he was walking back and forth, and back and forth, and back and forth, and I could feel my mind, or the attention, getting really drawn to this person. So I kept walking, you know, and with my board in my hand, and then I let the board go, and it went onto the sand. And I kept walking, and I moved up to him like this, and I just looked, and I could feel my mind getting pulled inside, you know, very, very slowly. It just felt like it was being pulled inside. And then suddenly the mind started to shift, and the perception started to shift, and this other happiness started to come into the mind. It was like I could feel this smile coming into the mind. And it was just a fleeting moment. It was one of those fleeting moments. I'm sure some of you, or all of you, have had something like this before. And then I just sort of shook my head and walked away, you know, because I had to meet the other people. And that was the beginning. And we travelled some months to get to England. And I happened to be working in this place in England. There was a guy working there, and he said, "Do you want to go to a Thai temple?" And I'm looking and going, a Thai temple in London? I'm imagining golden spears. You know, if you've been to Thailand, you know what the temples are like there. I said, "Sure, why not?" You know, because I was being reminded, this memory was starting to come up of this state of mind. You know, and there was a certain wanting for that state of mind. And so I said, "Yeah, I'll go to that." And so we went to this Thai temple, and it happened to be in an old house. It wasn't, you know, there was no golden spears, etc., etc. It was just in this house. And there were monks there, Thai monks, and they had a Buddha Rupa, and it was all set up with all the paraphernalia. And the monk, we sat down on the floor feeling particularly awkward, trying to cross our legs, and our legs were up like this, and hands were all over the place like this. But the monk just kept smiling, and I thought, this is pretty cool, you know, quite like this. You know, then he chanted Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddha Tassa, like this. And then that was another thing. I'm going, wow, this is really cool, you know. And also I could feel the quietness coming into the mind. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddha Tassa, Namo Tassa Bhagavato. And he chanted like this. I'm going, whoa, this is really nice. And then he said, what I'm going to teach you is how to find happiness. How to find happiness. And I said, okay, that sounds good. And for every week for the next year, I went to this teacher, and he taught me Vipassana meditation. And we were living in a flat in London, apartment. Is that how you say it here, flat apartment in London, with a group of people. But I used to practice on a daily basis. You know, I would do sitting, walking, meditation, go off to walk, come home, do sitting, meditation, walking, meditation. I'd try to be mindful of all my activities. And I'd go and see him once a week. And I discovered that to find happiness was actually very difficult. But still the moments would arise where this other level of happiness would come into the mind. And that's how it began for me and how it continued on. And 40 years later, I'm still here doing it because of what you learn in meditation is the ability to access happiness. You know, help yourself to happiness means to learn the skill to be able to access happiness. You know, these states of mind that are pure in the mind. Not all the time, but there's moments that come into the mind. Now, this brings me back to, I didn't know at that point very much about what the Buddha had taught. You know, I didn't know anything about what the Buddha had taught at that point. But of course the monk was teaching us each week and he talked about the levels of happiness. You know, he said, and I could see this was starting to gel in my mind because I could see through my own direct experience what was actually happening with these levels of happiness. Now, the Buddha described a number of levels of happiness that we can experience in our lives. And it's very important if you're on a spiritual path, which I'm presuming everyone here is because you're here, you know, that spiritual search, that search to attain something different, you know, something that's not of the ordinary, although it's ordinary in its own way, right? Would that be correct? My assumption would be true in that, I think. You know, so it says in the poster here, and the great teacher, Burmese teacher Mahasi Sayadaw, was one of the foremost meditation masters in the world, and I feel particularly grateful because he was really one of the first ones that was able to bring this meditation practice out of just being for monks and nuns to be accessible to lay people. And we were fortunate enough in the 70s to meet him and experience his teaching. So it was really a wonderful experience that not many people have had the honour, if you like, of experiencing. But he says in the beginning of his instructions, he says, everyone wants happiness, no one wants unhappiness. You know, and that got me. Everyone wants happiness, no one wants unhappiness. Is that right, do you think? That's correct, isn't it? Everyone wants happiness. Even birds, cats, animals, every animate being wants happiness. And there's different levels of happiness that can be achieved. And the Buddha also wanted happiness. You know, if you know the story of the Buddha, you'll understand that he came from a very wealthy family. He had a beautiful wife and children. He had all the luxuries of life. But still, he wasn't quite satisfied with the level of happiness that he achieved. But he accepted and then started to search for something else. But he accepted the level of happiness that is concerned with what he called it the lesser level of happiness, which is a really interesting term. And it's not something, I don't think he was talking here, that this level of happiness, which I'll describe in a moment, was bad. He was just saying it wasn't as good as the higher levels of happiness. But he said, most of us in the human realm, you know, we live in this lesser level of happiness without ever having the opportunity to experience a higher level of happiness. That's what I think he was searching for. And so when he saw the four signs, he was able to, you know, he renounced the world and he went off in search of this happiness, didn't he? You know, so that was quite remarkable. He was a very radical person, I think. You know, if he would have been born in this era, he still would have been particularly radical. You would have considered him to be quite radical, I think. But he talked about this lesser level of happiness as our ordinary, everyday human existence. You know, how we live our life. You know, how we get involved with the sense doors. You know, the eye, ear, nose, taste, smell. The ideas in our mind. How we develop relationships, how we have jobs, how we have children, how we go surfing, how we become artists, painters, singers, how we go to the movies, go to the theatres, to experience happiness. You know, we do all these things to experience happiness. You know, we may say in our minds, oh yes, it's because, you know, we want to be educated. Well, of course that's important. Buddha didn't deny that. But when you look really deeply into this, it's because of, and truthfully, often all the things that we create for ourselves are to do with that we're not happy. You know, there's some disquiet in the mind. And this is what the Buddha discovered, I think. So that level of happiness is called the level of happiness concerned with clinging and craving in the mind. Clinging and craving in the mind. And it's what we're mostly involved with. But why did he call it the lesser level of happiness? Isn't it great to have a really nice family, to have children, to have cars, to have education? It is, of course. And the Buddha, I think, didn't deny that. There's many stories about the Buddha, for example, who passed, say, a lute player. I've read these in the suttas, where the Buddha would pass a lute player. And he would turn and go, oh, that's beautiful. You know, that sound is beautiful. But then he'd walk on. And his mind didn't say, I have to go to the next concert. And what I'm saying here, there's no attachment in the Buddha's mind. He had the experience, appreciated, and he let it go. With us in the ordinary everyday life, we have experience, but we don't let things go. We want more of it. We want that to be our security, these continuing moments of experience to be our security. We want to repeat those experiences time and time and time again. For example, through the hearing door, you know, if we enjoy music, certain types of music, you know, you may have someone that enjoys pop, punk. You know, then you'll have someone that enjoys classical or Indian classical. You know, someone enjoys this and that. And you'll go after that. You'll go to all the places that will give you that enjoyment. Right? I mean, for me, being brought up in the 70s, I enjoy Crosby, Stills and Nash. And my staff in my business that I run, they tell me all these things. I have no idea what they're talking about. You know, and they put something on, they go, oh, please turn that off. Or I try to be detached from it, you know, what's going on. So hearing, coming through the hearing door, we relate to things and experience things through our sense doors and touching a sense or coming in contact with a sense object. Our children, you know, we have children, right? And that's a really beautiful thing to have. It's a hard one for people. But what happens if the children don't turn out as we want them to turn out? Oh, is there happiness? No, it's unhappiness. So those kind of things start coming into our mind. Oh, that person's got a Porsche. You know, do you think, oh, maybe I should get a Porsche? And the mind starts going round and round and round and round until, you know, you can get a BMW. Is that better than a Porsche? Something better than a Porsche. So we get caught up in all these kinds of things. If we're a foodie, you know, if we're interested in the taste door, right, then we'll chase after that perfect Indian meal. And I'm the worst in the world with this one. right? Having been in India, I'm really critical of Indian food if it's not good, you know, and I don't go as far as some of my friends who throw it on the floor. But I've seen this happen, you believe me. Mind gets caught up in all of these kinds of things. And so where does the mind go? It goes from moment to moment. One moment it's happy, one moment it's sad, one moment it's judging, one moment it's wanting more of something. It moves so quickly through this whole phenomenal experience that there's no quiet in the mind. It's like it's chasing after things all the time. And that's this level of happiness that the Buddha was talking about. You know, it's called the happiness of the sense doors. You know, he regarded it as a lesser level of happiness. Would you agree? Yes or no?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Okay, good. But I still go chasing after the perfect barrel. And looking for that perfect masala dosa. That level of happiness, when you think about it, 99% of the people in the world are living like this, you know, including us. There's only very few people who don't live like this. And we see through that lesser level of happiness, if you like, or the happiness of clinging, how much conflict is in the world. You know, how much actual unhappiness is in the world. How much chaos is in the world. Coming from people's attachment to experience through the sense doors. Coming from our attachment to experience through the sense doors. Now the Buddha went on then to say that there's another level of happiness, a higher level of happiness. And he described the happiness of renunciation. Now this sounds, renunciation, God, or restraint, if you like, the happiness of the restraint of the sense doors. This is something we do not want to know about. Very difficult. Happiness of, you know, that's due to restraining the sense doors. Especially in the West, and now more commonly in the East, where people are becoming Western, you know, wanting more. You know, this, I want that TV, and this, that, SUVs. And this is all happening in Asia now. It's starting to happen. If you've been there, you can see it. This higher level of happiness, though, comes through the restraint of the sense doors. And it's amazing, until you try it, until you're able to experience it for yourself, it seems so foreign. You know, why should I restrain my senses? You know, why shouldn't I react and act on, you know, my impulses and desires and habits? You know, that's what you keep asking yourself. Why shouldn't I have that? Why shouldn't I want that? Why shouldn't I go after that? Well, because the Buddha discovered that, and this is really the central core of the Buddha's teachings, is to do with that everything, phenomenal experience, is changing. Everything is impermanent. So everything we go after is an illusion. It's just changing. And through our meditation practice, we begin to see that really clearly. There is nothing there that we can actually get, because it's an illusion. It changes. You know, one moment it's there, the next moment it's gone. One moment it's there, the next moment it's gone. It arises, you know, because of cause and effect, it arises and passes away. You know? And the mind can stay peaceful and equanimous if you can see that. And so, according to the Buddha, that the restraint of the sense doors helps us see that more clearly. And in the beginning, of course, when you're undertaking meditation practice, we use it as a training. It's something we have to make an effort to do. But after a period of time, it becomes effortless. And so it happens naturally. that the mind restrains itself from going after things of the sense door so much. Can you see this? It happens. It starts to happen naturally for you. It's amazing. The first time I experienced it was really quite a transforming experience. You know, when you can see the very clearly, when the perceptions become so strong, awareness becomes so clear, crisp, able to see things very clearly, you can actually see the impulse to go after something. But then, like a rubber band, you can feel it come right back in again. And it's actually really amazing experience. And the mind, you can feel it going like this, and then it goes, it comes straight back in on itself, and it's really quiet and really delightful experience when this happens. And it happens more and more as you're practicing. You can feel this impulse to go out, sight, sound, taste, smells, touches, you know, like tactile sensations. You know. We spend a lot of time, especially on tactile sensations. I think I'll go and have a massage. Very nice. And it is nice. You know, the monks love massages. It's the only thing they can do. You know, because monks are not allowed to tickle, so they like, it's one of the rules, 227 rules of the monks is, one of them is, no tickling. No allowed to tickle. Right. But for some reason or other, it's okay for them to be massaged. So they have the novices sit there and massage their feet. You know, it must feel very nice. They're caught up in the pleasure of. But they say, oh, no, educational. I love that. I went on a boat ride once in Hawaii with one of the monks, a very senior monk who I respect very much. And I said, Sayadaw, do you, is this pretty, is this okay, cool to do this? Is it educational? I said, okay, educational, good. Educational, yeah. So things like, you know, we spend a lot of time really on looking after the body, and so we should, you know, we need to keep the body. But how much time do we spend looking after the mind in comparison to looking after the body? You know, we go and have, I have this, no massage therapist here, I don't want to put you out of business, right? But we spend an hour on massage or an hour on yoga or an hour on something like this, right? But even that's impermanent. That experience when you have a massage, it lasts only for a fleeting moment, doesn't it? You know, you feel a little bit better. You've escaped dukkha, suffering, just for a moment. And even within the massage, there's dukkha. Someone gave me a shoulder massage the other day, and I'm going, oh, this is real dukkha. You know, it's really hurting. Surfing is the same. You know, surfing, I go surfing, and I'm looking for this perfect experience, right? 62 years old, I get wiped out, I nearly drown. I'm a good surfer, you know, I rip. I wish I had been a pro surfer. You know, and it's hard work getting out there, paddling out and paddling back. I took the Sayadaw. A Sayadaw means a monk, for those that don't know, in Burma, like Ajahn in Thailand. So I'm saying, Sayadaw, come look at this, you know. We have a good relationship, Sayadaw and I. And he said, okay, let's go look at this. And down we go to the beach, and he's watching surf, and he said, too tiring. Paddle out, 1 minute, you paddle back in, get away. He said, that's a bit stupid, isn't it? And I said, yeah, you're right, probably. So the level of happiness of renunciation, and then there's a level of happiness that builds. This is really a progression. These level of happinesses build up as you mature in your practice. As the spiritual path becomes clearer, they build up. And you'll go from the lesser level of happiness to the higher levels of happiness as you become more cool in the mind, as the mind starts to cool. You know, they talk about the mind in terms of Asian imagery as the fires. And they talk about our craving, our attachment, our defilement in the mind. They use this word defilement, which I love. It's a word that you would not dare say hardly because it's so Victorian. defilement. Your mind is defiled, right? With greed, hatred, and delusion. You know, yes, it is. Right. So defilement of the mind. You know, they talk about it as the fires of the mind, you know, the passions of the mind. And the sense doors of being the fires. And what meditation practice is able to do is, with the practice of mindfulness, is cool the fires through the sense doors. They call it the cooling process of mindfulness. And that's what happens with it. The next level is to do with concentration of the mind. Now, concentration of the mind is an art. It's something that we do, we make an effort to do. Concentration, of course, means one-pointedness of mind, being able to bring the mind to a focus. So it doesn't experience anything else through the sense doors. The mind is completely quiet and unaware in its highest form. If you practice concentration, there's 40 different methods of practicing concentration. Some of them you will know. Mindfulness of the breath, of the nostrils. It's called anapana meditation. Have you heard of this before? Where you concentrate on the breath, keep the mind steady on the breath till it experiences various sensations. You ignore everything else. You know, nothing is important. Usually you need certain conditions to do this practice in. A quiet place, good food, no distractions whatsoever. And you need to put a lot of effort. We use our willpower to get to this point. We might use a mantra. You know, the Tibetans might use Om Mani Padme Hum or something like that. You know, the Hindus will use Om Shivai or something. So in all the different traditions they practice this concentration, which brings you the result of complete tranquility and calmness. Absolute complete tranquility and calmness. And within that is different levels of the maturity of the concentration practice. It's very, very beautiful. And people love it. And they love doing it because it brings the mind to something that's so extraordinary. It's unbelievable that this could actually happen to your own mind. Concentration meditation is the happiness that the Buddha was, that type of concentration was the concentration the Buddha was talking about here. And it is what the Buddha practiced himself as an ascetic. If you know the life of the Buddha, you'll know that he went off for 6 years and practiced these various ascetic practices so he could attain to these really high levels of concentration practice, because at that time in India, that was all that was known about. All the teachers were skilled in bringing the students to these high states of concentration. I mean, even in our everyday life now, even if we don't reach these jhana, it's called jhana, some of you will know this, called jhana states of mind, even when the mind is concentrated just in everyday life, we feel better, don't we? Because the mind's not flitting around all over the place. It's quiet, you know. So we, even in the lower levels of concentration, we still feel better. And we need concentration. We need to have concentration to be able to function quite okay in the world. You know, it's just that we don't mature it or don't grow it, if you like. You know, that's the difference. Concentration meditation, though, has a problem. That if you don't do it, all it is, has actually done is suppress the defilements in the mind. It's only a temporary relief. And this is what the Buddha discovered, that it was only a temporary relief, and why he went off and took the milk rice, sat underneath the Bodhi tree, and within a short period of time became the Buddha. From Siddhartha Gautama, he became the Buddha. He said, well, when I'm not in this state, my mind still has the potential to be angry, still has the potential to be judgmental, to be envious, to be jealous, to be have many destructive emotions running around in the mind. And maybe they don't arise so much because the concentration is quite strong and can sort of suppress these things quite well. But still he discovered that the defilement was still latent in the mind. Given certain conditions, it could come up. Given certain conditions, it could arise. So the mind was still not yet pure, still not yet purified. So it was then that he said, how am I going to, I guess, he was saying, well, what am I, now what am I going to do? And he sat there and he started to open his awareness to experience. He used the power of his concentration to open his mind, develop his awareness, cultivate, establish in his mind this very strong awareness so he could be aware of all the sense doors. And he could be aware and experience within that those sense doors the true nature of things, the truth of things, the characteristics of this human existence. And in so doing, free the mind from, when he was able to look and see this, he discovered that, oh, well, that's what the cause of suffering is. And you'll know the Four Noble Truths. You know, you'll know that the Buddha, the first Noble Truth is that the inherent nature of what we experience is has the tendency for suffering. Right? It's not that everything's suffering, but it has the tendency or potential to produce suffering. Right? And he discovered that the cause of that was because we attach to things, we cling to things. Right? That's what his big discovery was. But fortunately for us, the Buddha went further and said that if you're able to understand this, then the mind can come to the nibbanic peace. They call it Santi Sukha. Santi Sukha in Pali. You know, Santi is peace and Sukha is happiness. They call it the level of happiness of Nibbana. You know, where the mind is free from defilement in the mind. All defilement in the mind is removed. Nothing can happen that will create defilement to arise in the mind. No experience can touch the sense doors, which will allow it to go out of kilter, if you like. So that's the last level of happiness, is this level of Santi Sukha, this highest level of happiness, which we're all yet to experience. But pretty quickly, if we're mindful enough, we'll experience it. At some point along the way. So this level of happiness is going back to the lesser levels of happiness. You know, I think that the Buddha was seemed to be very clever here, because he didn't want to put people off, right? Searching. So he said, "Oh, you know, in the lesser levels of happiness, right? As long as you understand, and this is the important part, what is actually going on here? You know, if you develop." So I've seen some yogis, you know, meditators, who develop ill will towards the lesser levels of happiness, you know, towards the sense doors and towards experience and what we're doing in the world. This is not the Buddha's path. Absolutely not. The Buddha's path is not to build up ill will. It's to get rid of ill will from the mind. Right? So we don't have ill will towards the things of the world. We appreciate them, but we don't attach to them. Right? We know that things are changing, you know. So that's the important point here. And that's what I've got mostly from this Buddha's teachings, is to be able to understand this. So if there's no waves, okay. You know, if the shop's closed, okay. Right? No problem. You know, no problem in the mind. You know, mind stays cooled out. You know, if the plane's late, it's okay. If that person, you know, cuts me off in the car, we don't bring out the bazooka. You know, it's this kind of mind that we want to achieve in our everyday life. You know, this mind that has an equanimity towards the impacts of the sense doors. Right? And I think that's the most important thing. And then we can build on that. You know, we can build on that with our practice. You know, we can build on, we can experiment. You know, what's it like to restrain the door, the sense doors? You know, it's one of the trainings that comes in. Can I, can I restrain my seeing? You know, and what happens when I do that? For example, I go down to Waikiki Beach. I'm a real Hawaii boy, you know. I go down to Waikiki Beach, but I'm teaching a retreat, right? Oh, and, you know, I'll go for a walk or something in the afternoon, and I'll go down the crystal clear water, the trade winds are blowing, all the, you know, Hawaii dudes are out there surfing, and I can feel my mind wanting to go there, you know, but I don't let it go there. I just bring it back, and it's cool. You know, so no suffering in the mind. Maybe a little bit. But not a lot of suffering, a little bit. Sympathetic joy for their enjoyment, right? I'm developing mudita. Right. Do you understand what I'm saying here?
Yes.
Good. So that's the way we could try to live our world, our life in the world. You know, a life that has restraint. You know, when the situation requires it. You know, and but then when we need to do things and we need to function in